Well, thank you, John. Appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us.
Thanks for talking to me.
Well, I guess I want to start with something you've written about before, but at the risk of making you repeat yourself. You know, what do you see as the major causes of the financial crisis? I realize
not
a small question.
Well, I'll try and address it on several levels, if that's okay. I mean, when you get something this big, it seems to me you're never going to have a monocausal explanation. You know, this thing encompasses so many different sectors of the financial industry, you know, starting out with the people who are buying mortgage all the way through the subprime chain right to the European banks who ended up buying the securities that, you know, if you're looking, you're talking people in different continents, it's hard to think that one simple explanation is going to, you know, apply to everybody involved. But having said that, I think, you know, there are two or three sort of theories out there. One of which is that I think if you ask the man on the street what caused it, they would say it was crockery and greed, basically, sort of Madoffism writ large. I think that's, you know, as I said, it's a popular explanation. If you talk to economists, I'd say the close to the conventional wisdom now is that it was largely due to overconfidence and disaster myopia, a sort of behavioral economics explanation, which Bob Shiller, George Akerlof, and people have put forward. It was all a matter of animal spirits. People lost sight of reality. They thought the real estate market could never crash. They forgot that markets sometimes got into bubbles, etc. So there's a sort of behavioral explanation there. And then the third possible set of explanations, I think, focuses on bad incentives. And the key there is that people can act rationally at an individual level, but collectively their actions add up to an irrational, disastrous outcome.
Right.
That is my explanation, my favorite explanation. I've called it rational irrationality, not a particularly original phrase. But it seems to me that the crockery and the greed and the overconfidence and the disaster myopia were more symptoms of the bubble and the sort of, you know, the whole sort of dysfunctional operation of the financial system than causes. If you're looking to find, you know, the ultimate causes, I think you have to look at what was motivating people at every level of the mortgage chain. And it seems to me that sure there was overconfidence along it to some degree, and sure there was some crookery here and there, probably more than here and there, but I think the most sort of blatant commonality is this idea that people were basically reacting to market incentives in a quite in what to them was a quite rational and sort of self-seeking way, but the market, because it was in a bubble, was sending the wrong signals and giving people the wrong incentives. So my book and what I've been arguing for the last year or two is, you know, that's basically the way we should look at this. And of course the policy implications for that are then, you know, you have to address the incentives. It's no good just, you know, telling people not to be crooks or not to be overconfident. You have to then address the causes of the bad incentives. Because of course in all these explanations, they're all at different levels. You say, okay, bad incentive, what caused the bad incentives? Then you've got to look at, you know, the policy decisions, including the Federal Reserve, which was set in the sort of macroeconomic environment. I think, you know, one of the big reasons why people got wrong signals was because of the Fed allowed a speculative bubble to develop. And when you're in a speculative bubble, almost by definition, the market is sending signals to people to act irrationally in the long term because they think they can make money in the short term. And although, you know, obviously other government actions as well in terms of lack of regulation and providing implicit or explicit government guarantees. It's a sort of too big to fail problem, not just on Wall Street, but obviously Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. And then, you know, things like the incentive structures within these institutions, which again were giving people incentives to act myopically rather than to take sort of long-term view. None of that, as I say, is particularly original, I don't think. I mean, I've been writing about the Fed ever since I wrote The New Yorker 15 years ago, making largely the same points. But I just think they all came together in this sort of, you know, second bubble we've had in 10 years. So that's the gist of my argument.
Well, let's talk about the Fed a second. I mean, do you think? I know it's obviously a question of hindsight, but I mean, do you think had they not lowered rates and kept them low for such a sustained period that this might not have?
Well, I mean, you know, it's, I mean, obviously it's a very disputatious argument. I mean, I think you've got to give some credence to the sort of Greenspan, Bernanke argument that it was a sort of wall of money from abroad, because long-term interest rates, even when they raised short-term interest rates, long-term interest rates didn't come up as much as they usually do. So I think to some extent, you know, the wall of money argument needs to be, you know, there's certainly an element of that. But I do still think that the, not so much the absolute levels of interest rates, but the fact that people in the markets believe that interest rates weren't going up anytime soon, and the explicit signal that the Fed gave to people on Wall Street that, you know, rates would be low for an extended period, plus the history of the Greenspan Fed over, ever since the sort of 90s, of following what I would call an asymmetric policy, i.e., when the economy is doing very well, tightening very slowly, and when the economy, when there's a crash or an economic downturn, loosening very rapidly. I think that did add up to a sort of Greenspan put, to use the phrase. And I think, in each instance where the Fed was faced with these decisions, you know, like in 2004, should we raise interest rates? It's, you know, it's very difficult to do it. I understand that, you know, there were signs of that the recovery might not be as strong as it appeared. So you can always make the rationale that each individual decision was sensible at the time. But I think over the course of 10 or 15 years, the Fed, and not just Greenspan, all the people, you know, the people sat on the board as well, lots of whom are, you know, liberal economists, not conservative economists, allowed themselves to get into a sort of overall policy framework which was basically conducive to speculative bubbles arising. And you know, if you look at this, if you think it's an incentive problem, which is my argument, you have to ask yourself who can sort of overcome these incentives. If everybody in the markets and in the housing market on Wall Street is just reacting to the markets, who's outside the system? Who can sort of, you know, take a broader view of what's in the social interest and not just the private interest? And that's got to be the policymakers. So I think that's why they, you know, bear some responsibility, because they set up the entire sort of macroeconomic framework within which people were operating. And as I say, notwithstanding the fact that if you may be able to justify some or not all of, if not all, the decisions on an individual basis, if you just go back and look at the FOMC transcripts or whatever, I think overall the Fed allowed itself to get trapped in what turned out to be a sort of mistaken and very damaging policy framework.
Right. We're also joined by our general counsel, Gary Cohn, who's here.
Hi, Gary.
Hi. I want you to know I read your book, enjoyed it, and that's where I learned who Hyman Minsky was.
Thanks.
Which one is that?
Well, let me ask you something. You know, the commission has the authority to subpoena documents and has no jurisdictional boundaries, so we're free to investigate pretty much what we want. And I guess I want to ask you, what do you not know about this crisis that you would like to know, or that you think we should look at?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, as far as Wall Street's concerned, I guess, you know, there's been a lot of focus there, but I'm still quite puzzled just as to the sort of internal deliberations of some of these big banks as to how they got into the mortgage market and how much they knew about it. I mean, UBS did an internal report, which I think was, you know, pretty exhaustive and taught me a lot. I quoted it at length in the book. But none of the American big banks did that, as far as I know. And I would imagine that it was pretty much the same story. The people at UBS, basically at the top of the bank, didn't realize the risk that had been taken on down below, and the people down below were all paid on basically a commission. So there was, and they relied on unreliable risk models. So it may be a familiar story, but I would like to know what was happening inside Citi, Merrill, Goldman a bit more, and whether, you know, even at board level, for example, anybody stood up and said, you know, you should or shouldn't do this. For example, Citi, I use the example of Chuck Prince, who's obviously become the fall guy for a lot of this. It's still a bit of a mystery to me how and why Citi got into the subprime so big so late. I mean, there's this story which I'm going around, you know, that the committee of the board came to him in 2004, 2005, whoever, and said, you know, we're falling behind in fixed income, you need to ramp it up, etc. And that he went along with it. Maybe Bob Rubin was involved. I just don't know. I don't know the at that level of granular detail what happened, but it would be, I'd be interested to know, because, you know, there's a lot of very smart bankers who ended up making some very, very unwise decisions, and I think any light that could be shed on that would be helpful. I mean, I did a story myself about Merrill Lynch and how they got involved, focusing on Stan O'Neill, and it was pretty clear to me doing that story that Stan and the other people right at the top of the firm basically didn't understand what they were getting into, and sort of, well, they, lots of the, you know, the big question is, did they realize that they, a lot of this stuff could come back to them? I think at Merrill, and I presume at Citi, they didn't. I mean, Stan, for example, you know, believed that they were basically just warehousing all this subprime stuff, so there was no risk, it wasn't on the banking book. But of course, you know, if there's a big stop, then it comes back onto the banking book very quickly. Did the other banks, you know, did they take account of that? So that's the sort of stuff journalists can't get out, because nobody will tell us. UBS, as I say, I think did a reasonable job sort of fessing up and explaining what happened.
Right. You know, did you have anything?
No, go ahead.
As a larger question, you know, I mean, the next crisis, and there's bound to be one, almost certainly is not going to be about...
Oh, so just say one more thing, which is one other puzzle, which I think I mentioned to Phil when I had lunch with him a few months ago, which is still a mystery to me. Just this question of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, how much they propped up the subprime market. You know, I know the figures are very complicated. You guys could just provide the actual some facts as to when they got involved, how much they spent. I know there's, you know, it depends how you define subprime, etc. But it seems to me Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac's involvement, obviously they're central figures in the housing market, everybody knows that, but it still seems to me it's a bit of an unresolved question as to how much they had to do with the rise of subprime. I'm sort of of the view that they didn't have very much to do with it, and that they sort of came in very late when it was already up and running, and because they thought they were falling behind the competition, so that they were just sort of joining the herd rather than directing the herd. But I think the sort of underlying facts are still unclear, or at least I don't know them, and I think that would be definitely a public service if you could sort of just clear up their involvement.
Well, we are looking at Fannie and Freddie very carefully, and you know, that's one of the areas of controversy as to whether, you know, whether they were a cause or, you know,
exactly. But, I mean, I just don't know the actual. I mean, I tried for my book to just try and get some figures on what they bought, and it was just very hard. I mean, you know, the definitions all change. You know, different sources give different figures. When you go to them, they say, you know, we didn't buy very much, but then there's this argument that they were buying sort of semi-subprime stuff. Obviously, even if you don't reach a final conclusion, just laying the facts out, I think, would be very valuable. Because obviously, going ahead, the fate of Fannie and Freddie is going to be, you know, another big policy issue. So I think it'd be very valuable to get the actual facts on the table.
Yeah, you're right. The area of definitions, what's subprime, what's Alt-A, and the rest, are fluid, and we are working on trying to create some consistency in that very, very area. So you're correct. That's an area that needs work, and we're trying to do it.
Right. sorry, Matt.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, there's bound to be another crisis down the road, and it's almost certainly not going to be about mortgages and a housing bubble. I Just wondering on this on the larger question of, you know, how do you balance financial innovation, which presumably we want some of, and you know, the regulation needed to prevent the next crisis.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously that's a big question. I mean, I think a lot of it goes back to the compensation structures myself. I mean, you know, the question is what's a real innovation and what's an innovation which delivers, you know, a quick return for a few years but generates a lot of tail risk, which comes back to sink the firm after the guy's left and moved down the street. You know, when you're a trader, obviously, your incentives are to create profits this quarter, next quarter, the quarter after that. So I think the great unresolved issue here is compensation. And the Fed, again, you know, this time last year, for example, the Fed, you know, said they were there was a big front page story in the Wall Street Journal saying the Fed's going to really clamp down on Wall Street compensation practices, for example, and sort of make sure that people are paid mostly in, you know, stock that doesn't vest for years, etc. That seemed to be the gist of it. But as far as I know, very little's happened. I know they put out some guidelines back in June. But just talking to people on the street, I don't think the actual compensation practices have changed that much. And it seems to me, you know, that's where you talk about innovation. If something's a real innovation, then it should, for a bank, you know, I mean, it should generate profits 5-10 years down the road, not just 5-10 quarters down the road. So it seems to me that traders and the heads of trading departments, people like that, you know, should be paid in long-term stock or options, or whether with some sort of clawback facility. And I think, you know, most people on Wall Street agree with that, but again, it's this sort of prisoner's dilemma aspect of things. None of them can introduce it by themselves, because if they do, their competition will just take their stars. It has to be the government to come in and coordinate that. You know, Lloyd Blankfein, to his credit, I think actually said that about 12 or 18 months ago, and certainly John Mack did, that, you know, it needed the government to come in and impose this because we can't do it by ourselves. Again, that's, you know, this issue of rationalist irrationality. I mean, it's a classic prisoner's dilemma. The private solution that the players will come to is not optimal, not for them even. So, you know, that justifies government intervention in some way. And, you know, obviously Congress didn't want to take it on, or the administration didn't want to take it on, fair enough, but, you know, they've passed the buck to the Fed, so now it's up to the Fed to come in, and if they're going to be the sort of regulator of compensation practice, let's see what have they got to say. I haven't really seen very much follow-up on that.
What,
I mean, you know, again, there is no straightforward answer as to what's a genuine innovation and what's a bit of trickery. I mean, you know, in the financial markets, you don't really know until it's survived a cycle or not. So what you want to avoid is giving people all the upside in the upside of the cycle, and then, you know, not being able to take anything back, so the taxpayer ends up coming in and taking off most of the downside. So any move towards a more sort of symmetrical compensation practice,
right,
seems to me to be a good idea.
It's your view, after reading your book and looking at and listening to you now, say your view is that... Let me back up. We've been looking sort of at the why and the how.
Right.
The how is a mechanical process. The why, it sounds to me like you're laying a lot on the doorstep of asymmetrical compensation practices, and I guess you would say that applies both to both to the individual trader and executive and highly paid.
I mean, that's on Wall Street. I mean, you know, it was a chain, right? I mean, there's a subprime chain. So you start at one end of the chain, and you've got the guy who's sat in, you know, Ameriquest or wearing New Century around around the West Coast. And, you know, what's his compensation contract? He's basically being paid on commission, right?
Yeah.
So he doesn't really care or what the quality of the loan is. And his boss doesn't really care either, because they're securitizing it. So it's not just the compensation structure. The actual problem there was as much to do with the actual financial innovation securitization, which that's a classic. As I said last time, in the upside of the cycle, securitization looked great. It looked like it was bringing new capital into the industry, giving people access to mortgages who otherwise couldn't have got access, raising the home ownership rate. If you go back and just read the economics about securitization, virtually everybody thought it was a great idea until the sort of downside appeared when the cycle peaked and realized that it had created some sort of adverse incentives for the people who were dealing with it.
It went to the same point, I think, on the compensation item about removing the consequences from the initial
Exactly. The great defense for free markets is that the benefits and costs get attributed to the right people, and the problem is in some cases, especially when you've got a bubble, that doesn't happen. And the securitization and innovation, various innovations sort of contribute to that in a way which it's easy to say in hindsight. I wasn't writing in 2002 that securitization was going to blow up the housing market. So that's why, you just need to be more cautious about incenting people to create these things before we know the long-term consequences.
How much of a role do you think that sheer panic, not necessarily they're out to get me panic, but certainly market panic and participant panics played in this, particularly, I guess, after the uncertainty created by the failure to bail out Lehman?
Obviously there was an enormous panic. I think the key point is, though, that it's perfectly rational to panic. People weren't just going crazy. If you were a short-term creditor to Lehman, for example, it was perfectly rational to try and get it out, because if you didn't get it out, you're still stuck there. The bankruptcy process is still going on. So, same thing with repo market, various places. It's always going to be, the reason panics are so serious is not because people go crazy, it's because they don't go crazy. They realize that if they can get to the front of the queue, they can get their money out before everybody else. Mm-hmm. So, it's just another version of a banker's run, which we know all about from the 30s. It just this time it happened in the credit markets and very nearly in the money markets as well. So, all financial markets where you've got sort of maturity transformation gives the potential for panics. I think what we didn't realize was, how quickly they could develop in the credit markets, and especially in the repo markets, where people just thought that was, and that just makes sense in the money markets too. People just thought that was, as good as money.
John, do you have thoughts about, after the crisis was well underway, what the government should have done vis-a-vis Bear and Lehman?
I can see both sides of that one. At the time, it's obviously in retrospect, at the time I supported the bailing out of Bear, and I thought they should have taken over Lehman as well. I think the decision not to take over Lehman, obviously everybody said it was a mistake, it was, but they were under a lot of political pressure at the time. I think the real criticism of the Fed and the Treasury should be directed earlier, that they didn't sort of get ahead of it at any time. And it's pretty clear to me, and I'm not a great expert on banking, that all of these banks were in pretty serious trouble as early as the spring, and even the fall of 2007. So I know it would be very difficult to do, but some sort of setting up some sort of facility, some sort of government bad bank at that stage or whatever. I was leaning in that direction. Now, I know it was politically poisonous, but not to even, if you go, but you know, if you read, I'm sure you've got it, you know, Phil Swagel's account of what was going on inside the Treasury. You know, they didn't actually start thinking seriously about this stuff until the summer, I don't think. And if you just look around, there were people who had more experience in previous banking crises in Scandinavia and places who were saying, you know, the key thing is to get ahead of it and to establish that the sort of government is going to be there for the, as the sort of lender or market maker of last resort, whether that involves actually taking them over in a bad bank or in some sort of a bailout. I think that's the only way they could have prevented the ultimate collapse. Now, in the American system, given this constellation of Congress, etc., I'm sure important people would just say that wouldn't have been possible. But, you know, I'm not a politician, just looking at it as an analyst, I think that would have been the way you would have wanted to go. Because that's eventually, that's what eventually brought the panic to a stop. And I think it would have been cheaper if they had done it earlier. Mm-hmm. That's the usual lesson of banking crises, that the longer you wait, the more expensive and troublesome it is because of the panic question.
Do you think the changes in regulations, and I apologize if you talked about this before I came in, I guess starting, as I think you pointed out, with Carter and the airlines, and then accelerated perhaps under Reagan and Bush won. Do you think those regulatory changes, if they had not occurred, would have resulted in a different outcome, or do you think that?
Well, I mean, you know, we basically had a sort of repressed financial system from 33 to 82, and there weren't any financial crises, but. You know, so obviously if there hadn't been any, if you had a sort of strict Glass-Steagall and a sort of narrow banking system and sort of, you know, strict delineation with Wall Street, then I don't think there would have been this big blow-up, but, you know, you could argue that there wouldn't have been a lot of innovation, etc. I mean, it's obviously a big argument. I don't think necessarily, we necessarily want to go back to you know, as I say, I would call a repressed financial system. But I do think that the sort of advent of big universal banks with an implicit state guarantee, it will just causes trouble. So that's why I think everything that's been done has been good and I support it. But I think ultimately some way is going to have to found to sort of remove this implicit guarantee. And the only way I can see it actually working is to move towards the, breaking them up a bit. I found myself in the unusual position of agreeing with Alan Greenspan that, if they're too big to fail, they're too big to exist.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I know that's, it's a question of whether it's politically possible. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you go back to Glass-Steagall, that's more a matter of scale. It's clearly a scale at which these big banks are just too big to be allowed to collapse.
aside from compensation, which is off-sided as a fairly easy way to fix this, the whole...
Well, I don't think you're going to fix it, but, you know, it might help a bit, right?
Or at least help a bit, right. I should say. But, more capital, less leverage is off-sided. I mean, do you think that would help?
I think that's a tough one because, you know, it depends what you mean by capital. They were all well within the, as Dick Fuld always says, the day they collapsed, they were well within the sort of Basel requirements. They had tier one capital of whatever it was, 12-13%. So it's not just capital, I don't think. I mean, it's the fragility of the structure. Even if you've got sort of 20% capital and then 80% funded very short, you're still vulnerable to a run, you know, because 20% capital is never going to be able to cover everything. So I think capital is good, but you know, you've got to look at you know, what are the basis of the funding as well, and just the you know, the actual risk taking not abilities, risk taking capacities and practices within the firm. I mean, it was interesting to read, I think it was in Journal this morning or something, maybe the FT, a story saying that the New York Fed is now looking a lot more closely at the banks and asked them to break down the profits into, you know, trading, capital markets, etc., down to some level of nearly close to individual desks. I mean, they should have been doing that all along, obviously. I think that's, you've got to take a granular look at these banks. I mean, for example, I don't know if you looked at it, but one of the most interesting conversations I've had since the this whole thing blew up was with an economist who's looked closely at what happened in Spain. Spain's a disaster in some ways, but the big banks there, even though there was a property bubble, came out of it okay, Santander and people. So, you know, what did they do right that we did wrong? And according to him, it was basically a matter of old-fashioned regulation. The Bank of Spain just sent people in to the big banks in Spain, looked very closely at their loan book, and, you know, if they saw them doing expanding in subprime real estate or whatever, you know, they'd say, look, you need to stop that, it's too risky. You know, whereas we've gone to the opposite extreme of just allowing the banks to rely on internal risk models. So I think some old-fashioned bank regulation would be a big help. And that's not very glamorous, and you know, it's not going to get many headlines, but I think it has a big impact. It evidently did have a big impact in Spain. And I think that goes back to sort of internal culture of the Fed. I think what happened to the Fed in the last 20, 30 years, and it's not just at the Fed, other places as well, the sort of economists took over. You go back to Volcker. Volcker wasn't an economist, he was a banker and a bank regulator. I think he was a bank regulator at the New York Fed, and he's, you know, a lot younger. So I think what happened to the Fed is certainly under Greenspan, but again, it's not just Greenspan, generally speaking, people took a lot more notice of economists. Suddenly you have to have a PhD to be on the Fed board, and you have to be a PhD economist to be a sort of central banker. And the sort of regulation function, I think, got relegated. And the people who worked in it, you know, realized at the top of, you know, the people at the top of the bank weren't encouraging them to be aggressive. Same problem we had at the SEC and some of the other agencies. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think Volcker's idea, and I think it's in the reform bill, of appointing a deputy chairman for financial regulation who's answerable to Congress and has to go up there and explain what they're doing, is a good one. I think, you know, just regulation can work, but it's got to be, you know, it's sort of on the ground, going in there saying, well, why is this part of the loan book gone up by 20% in the last year? You know, who are you lending to? Mm-hmm. What risks are you taking? And, you know, they say, well, our model will say it's not risky. Well, you say, well, what do you mean? You know, you're running into all these REITs or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, it's not a science, but I think that would be a positive move. And it looks like they are doing it to some extent, according to the story I read this morning.
Right. Well, John, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time out. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I'm happy to answer any more questions if you've got it. I mean, you guys have got a tough... I mean,
yeah.
I stepped in it myself for a year. I know it's a monstrous task you've taken on.
It's big, no question. But like your book and appreciate it.
I wish you all the best, and I look forward to seeing what you come up with.
Okay, we do too.
So do we.
Thanks, John.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye.
Okay.
8:50. Hmm? 2 hours late now.
You are?
My flight, my 6:50 flight.
Oh, your 6:50 flight.
Now leaving at 8:50.
Dallas?
Dallas.
Dallas to L.A.?
Dallas to L.A.
Fantastic. And when are you back?
Monday morning. Red eye.
Ouch.
Oh, boy. What's that?
I think it's part of the Geary building.
What's that?
I think it's part of the Geary.
Geary building?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, it looked like the underside of some leaves.
Well, no, it's just one of those Microsoft screensavers. No, it looked kind of Geary-ish.
Yeah, it looks like it.
Bilbao more than the...
it's not Disney.
No. Where do you live in L.A.?
Southern
Nice out there.